Welcome to the Real Estate Way to Wealth and Freedom podcast with Jacob Ayers, providing actionable content to help you along your journey to financial freedom through real estate investing. As the premier asset class, real estate has helped ordinary people just like you amass fortunes. The benefits of passive income from real estate investing will allow you to live a life you want. And now, your host, entrepreneur, real estate investor, and apartment deal syndicator, Jacob Ayers.
Hi, and welcome to the Real Estate Way to Wealth and Freedom podcast, episode 66. I'm your host, Jacob Ayers. Today, our guest is Tyler Scheff. Tyler, founder of CashflowGuys.com, is a licensed real estate problem solver, educator, investor, and syndicator. Tyler has been involved in real estate for over 17 years and now maintains a 100% focus on investing for cash flow and helping others do the same. Today's topic is going to be around seller financing and negotiating those terms. Tyler has a ton of resources and tools in his belt that help him negotiate seller financing and come up with a solution for both himself and the seller. Without further ado, let's jump into today's episode. All right, today, welcome on the show, Tyler Scheff. Tyler, thanks for joining us this morning.
Hey, Jacob, glad to be here, man.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Tyler, could you tell the audience a little bit more about yourself and how you got started investing in real estate?
Well, you know, for me, I was like everybody else. I wanted to get rich quick, Jacob. I'll be honest with you. I went through that phase of, oh, man, I'm going to flip houses. I'm going to make millions of dollars. You know, this is going to be awesome. This was before the time of Home and Garden television. You know, they didn't have Flip This or Flop That or whatever the shows are that are going out there.
Yeah.
So I thought I was like, you know, this huge pioneer that I had the secret that nobody else had. And I got into it to make money. I was in my 20s. This is going back a long time ago. This is year 2000, going back to year 2000. And that's what got me going in it. That's not what kept me in it, but that's what got me going in it. So for me, you know, I got to be honest with you. I did really well flipping houses. I cringe when I say that because then I'm afraid that people are going to go out and start flipping houses now and they're going to blame me when it all goes wildly wrong. But when I got into flipping houses, there was a couple of things. I didn't know that you could do such a thing like assign a contract. And what's sad about that was I was a licensed realtor. They don't teach that in real estate school. I didn't know that I could just get something under contract and assign it. So I was actually buying houses. This is how Tyler wholesaled in year 2000. I would buy a house cash. And then I would stick it for sale sign in the front yard and resell it. So I'm paying like double closing costs. I didn't know any better.
Yeah.
So that presented its certain set of challenges, so to speak. It's like, oh, well, when I figured that out, then I felt pretty dumb. It's like, oh, well, I'm apparently an idiot.
Well, at least you're making it work at the time.
That's right. But we did really, really well flipping houses. I partnered up with some other guys. One guy brought capital. The other guy brought expertise as far as the contracting piece. I was always good at negotiating, and I learned early on how to be effective as a negotiator. So that was kind of the skill that I brought to the table, that, and I could find opportunities pretty well. I got good at finding opportunities and then negotiating those opportunities into great deals. So it was kind of originally a match made in heaven. $250,000 in loss later, I realized that I was a little off in my projections there. So whoops. So that was us. But realistically, yeah, we got started to get rich quick and then realized that that wasn't going to be the case. So I got out of real estate for a couple of years. I had one flip that went terribly wrong with some partners. One guy left the country with $250,000 of our money, left us with a 3,000 square foot house that was in various states of construction. The city was cracking down on us for not pulling permits, and it was just an absolute nightmare. So that kind of scared me away from real estate for about 5 years.
Yeah. Well, Tyler, when you came back into real estate, what were you doing then?
Well, it's funny because my wife was like, okay, it's time. You're going to have to go out and get a job. Like me, you're no fun. So I went out and got a great job working for the government. I'm a veteran. So getting hired by the federal government was pretty easy, being a veteran with an honorable discharge and all that. So what I did was I got going in a little organization called NOAA, which is the National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration. And people more commonly know it as the National Weather Service. And I was working on ships. Well, doing what I was doing, I was making an insane amount of overtime. So my paycheck was huge. I mean, I was well over the 100K mark, which means the IRS loved me. I got my own parking spot out front of the building, I'm pretty sure. So even though I joined the government trying to get my act together financially, I created a taxable situation for myself, just like I did when I was flipping houses. You know, see, the thing about flipping houses, Jacob, was that's great. I flipped a house and I thought I made all this money, but realistically, now I have to pay the tax man. So there goes half my profits right to my taxes. And people say, oh, it's not half. Well, actually, it is half. If you figure FICA and lost opportunity costs and everything added together, if you're not making the numbers work, in other words, forcing the numbers to do what they're not designed to do, and you're actually honest with yourself, well, you're paying a lot of taxes.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I think that's probably a big misconception of real estate investing, Tyler, is you think you hear all of these tax advantages, but in some of the niches like flipping, you do pay extraordinary income tax on those types because it is just a service day job. So yeah, something to think about for somebody looking to get in that kind of niche.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And, you know, when I came in the second time around, I'll be honest with you, Jacob, I was terrified of getting back into that. So how I wound up in real estate the second time around, I call it my second act, is I was looking for a way to reduce my taxes because I was working as a W-2 employee for the federal government. And although they were paying me a fortune on one side, the other side of the government, also known as the IRS, was taxing me to death. So that's what led me back into real estate. I was actually Google searching how to legally reduce my taxes. And I came up with real estate, if you could believe that.
I could believe it. So where'd you go from there, Tyler? What kind of niche did you get into?
Well, one thing I figured out is that the way to truly reduce my tax obligation was to basically play by the rules, to do exactly what the IRS wants me to do. In other words, Tom Wheelwright, who is one of the Rich Dad Advisors, he's a tax expert. In his book, he's written a couple books, but in the one I'm thinking of, he talks about if you want to change your tax, you have to change your facts. So I didn't initially understand what that meant because, you know, I'm not the smartest guy in the room all the time. And I realized that really came down to I needed to change how I earned my money, okay, how I actually earned my revenue. And if I changed how I earned my income, I could dramatically change my tax situation. So what that boiled down to was, hey, dummy, quit flipping houses. Just keep them. Just hang on to them. And I learned that once I hang on to them, now I've eliminated capital gains. I've eliminated all these extra taxes, ordinary income, and I'm now being taxed on a completely different type of income. Therefore, my tax bill essentially went away.
Yeah, right. I'm sure that's very impactful to your bottom line at the time.
Yeah, there was a time I was paying more in tax, Jacob, than most of my friends made. Gross.
Yeah, that's sickening. And you know, you've got to do something differently. So it's funny that you ran across real estate investing or buy and hold investing, at least through a quick Google search of how to reduce your taxes.
Absolutely. Not the last thing you would think of that would help you get that direction. But, you know, unfortunately, it did get me to where I am. And yeah, I'd love it. But for me, I needed to scale. You know, I'm not a young man anymore. I got back into this game and I was 44 when I got back into the buy and hold game. And that's only a couple of years ago. And I realized I had to build my portfolio pretty quickly. The only way I couldn't do that was single family houses. It just wasn't possible.
Yeah. So what did you find, Tyler, that was your, that fit what you needed?
For me, I needed more tenants paying me every month. And for that to happen, I had to go to apartment buildings, which, you know, initially I thought that was complex. I thought this is very difficult. I'm going to have a hard time with this. I'm not smart enough. I don't have enough money. All the different limiting beliefs that one can have, I had all of those. But I was able to get through it. And once I started to scale, it went crazy.
Yeah, well, let's kind of drill down on that transition, Tyler. So you first started flipping houses because you wanted to make quick cash flow, realized that you were just getting taken to the cleaners with taxes, set out for a couple years, came back in, decided, hey, buy and hold is where I want to be, and then quickly transitioned into apartments. So could you talk about how you came back into the real estate investing game and then just started buying apartments?
Well, at the time, I was at sea, and I was still working for the government, and I had a satellite phone. I thought the path I was under the assumption I needed to be on was I was supposed to be a wholesaler, even though at the time I was just renewed my real estate license. Everybody kept saying, oh, you got to wholesale, you can wholesale your way to wealth. And what I realized is that wholesaling is a job. I spent more hours wholesaling probably than I ever have worked in my life. It's a lot of work. I mean, a ton of work. So I realized that wasn't going to work for me, and I couldn't live, you know, at $10,000, $15,000 a month paydays wasn't really going to get me anywhere because I'm earning income the same way I was getting taxed to death previously. I had to change the way I earned my income. So immediately it was like, okay, we're going to scale. I'm going to buy apartment buildings. I need money to do that was my mindset. What I realized is I just needed to add a word. I thought I needed my own money. Okay. So I had to just take the words my own out of that equation. Yes, I needed money, but I didn't necessarily need my own. What I needed was to surround myself with people that had all the tools I needed to put a deal together. And that's kind of how I broke out and started doing it. I learned how to raise capital by solving problems. And that was the game changer for me.
Yeah, that's kind of the true job of a real estate investor is to be a problem solver for either the seller or your investors or anybody in your circle. You are the problem solver. So could you talk about what some of those problems you were solving, Tyler?
Well, you know, a lot of people, they don't believe that that's the case. And I'm glad you mentioned it because a lot of people don't think that's the case. They think their idea of getting a great deal is beating the seller up and getting the property at a reduced price. Well, as a buy and hold investor, it doesn't really matter what you pay as far as a purchase price for a property. What matters is what's your holding cost? What does it cost you every month to control the asset? That's truly what it means, you know, what matters. That's what's most important. So that said, I learned to find out why the sellers are selling, first of all, okay? Because everybody thinks that the sellers want top dollar and they want all cash. You ask any real estate agent, and I can say this, I am one. Any real estate agent on the planet will tell you, because they don't know any better, they never ask, what is your seller? Why is your seller selling? Well, because they want to relocate to a better house and they want to capitalize on an up market and they all want cash. But what that really means is I'm terrible at being a real estate agent. And if I don't get this paycheck, I'm not going to be able to eat and my kid's going to get thrown out of school and I'm going to lose the payments on my Mercedes and I won't be able to get new glamour shots next year. So please buy this house quickly because I can't afford to wait for you to get a mortgage is really what it comes down to. I've decided that if I could get direct to the seller, if I could eliminate the gatekeepers, the incompetence from the mix, and I could actually sit down directly with the sellers and have a conversation and discover why they are selling. But the next step beyond that, Jacob, is to find out what in the world are you going to do with the money? What are you going to do when we close? I mean, we're going to pay the bank off because you may have a mortgage. So if you got a mortgage, we got to pay that off, right?
Right.
But because that's what most people want. Granted, there's things like subject to and whatever, but it's not necessarily my cup of tea. But you have to pay, you have to satisfy this loan. So you're going to have some proceeds, Mr. Seller. And Jacob, when I buy your house today, what are you going to do with that huge pile of money? I'm going to put that right here on the kitchen table. What are you going to do with it? Can I come back next year and visit it? Well, heck no. What are you going to do with it? Well, I'm going to buy a jet ski. I'm going to take my wife to Europe and I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. And I'm going to go buy another property. I'm going to go do whatever. And are you going to go pay cash for your next real estate property, your next real estate investment?
No.
You're a sophisticated investor. I'm sure you know better than that, right? And of course, what are you going to say? Well, of course I wouldn't pay cash. That'd be silly. Well, exactly. Neither would I. Now that we've got that ironed out, let's talk about giving you payments for your equity. How about that?
That's awesome. So you're kind of leading the conversation into potentially seller financing at that point?
Absolutely. Seller financing is always the first thing I try. And I'm more successful than most people because my primary leads that I look for are free and clear properties. I always look for free and clear properties.
And what makes a free and clear property more inclined to do seller financing, Tyler, than somebody who has a mortgage?
Well, they don't have the belief system that they have to pay anybody off. In other words, first of all, so they have complete control. They can do whatever they want. They don't answer to a bank or anything like that. So it makes the transaction simpler, less complex. Okay. And remember, people, Jacob, fear what they don't understand. So when they hear somebody tells them that there's a due on sale clause in their mortgage.
Yeah.
It scares the heck out of them. And friends of family, attorneys, whoever may tell them, hey, you've got a due on sale clause. Or if they actually read their mortgage, shocking, if people actually do that, but they read their mortgage and go, oh, well, I've got to pay this mortgage off. Well, technically, that's an agreement between you and the bank. It's not a law, but yeah, you could cause some undue scrutiny to come upon you if you sell your house and don't pay off your mortgage. They might get a little testy if they found out. So, but the free and clear person, they don't have any of that to worry about. And at the end of the day, what else are they really going to do with their money? I mean, what if I handed you $100,000 right now and you weren't a real estate investor, what would you do with it? Would you put it in a savings account and make what? Less than 1%?
That would probably be the first step, yeah.
Yeah. Would you buy a CD and maybe get 1.25% and then, you know, would you leave it there for the government to tax you on it? I mean,
yeah,
at the end of the day,
that's another point, right? Tax liability on this sale.
Absolutely. If you carry around a pile of money, I assure you, someone will help themselves to it at some time, whether it be the IRS or some hoodlum down the street. Somebody's going to help themselves to it.
Yeah. So your first approach with sellers, Tyler, sounds as leading them down to the path to understand that, hey, seller financing could be a position that works for both of us here through some of these questions like, what are you going to do with your money? Let them understand the tax benefits of it. Can we talk about the tax benefit portion from your negotiation standpoint? How do you frame that conversation?
Absolutely. Well, one of the things that I will say most often is I don't ever talk in absolutes when we talk about taxes, because after all, I'm not a CPA. I'm not certified as a tax professional. But I tell people, hey, you know, Jacob, so you're the seller. Jacob, I'm of the understanding, and I may be wrong, but I'm of the understanding that if you sell your house, in the most cases, you have to pay a very large portion of the proceeds of the sale to the IRS in the form of taxes. So when I write you a check for this house, do you want me to write one check to you and you're going to pay them? Or do you want me to go ahead and write a check directly out to the IRS?
That is quite the dilemma.
The key there is complete silence after you drop that little nugget, because you will hear it. You will smell smoke and you will see smoke. They'll be like, oh my God, I got to pay the government. Turning. Right. And whether or not they have to pay taxes, really, we're not tax professionals. We don't know. But I encourage them immediately to get with their tax professional. Because Jacob, you know, you as a home seller, if the person buying your home is not really concerned about your tax obligation in doing so, I would be concerned about a cash offer that puts you in that position to have to pay those large taxes. Before we do business, maybe you should talk to a tax professional. I don't want to lead you down a path and you not be up to speed on the result of me giving you cash. I can give you cash. That's no problem. But if I do that, it may come with ramifications. So what did I do, Jacob? Anybody else that comes in there, you know, the guy toting a fistful of $100 bills, I've got cash and I can close in 4 hours. That guy's going to get the door closed in his face in a lot of cases.
Yeah, so it helps kind of eliminate some of those fly-by-night competition, per se.
Yeah, and there's a lot of those out there. We both know that. Everybody's a wholesaler. I mean, if you can fog a mirror, you're a wholesaler. That's just the way it is in today's society. You got realtors out there that, frankly, aren't much better. They're not skilled in these type of things. They don't realize what happens after the closing. And to be honest, a lot of them simply don't care, which is a sad statement in itself, but it is what it is.
Yeah, so Tyler, now that you've kind of got the seller kind of thinking along the lines of where you want them to be, another approach, if I'm not mistaken, is to let them understand that, hey, you know, what are you going to do with this money? Put it in a savings, put it in a CD and earn 1.5%. Well, hey, seller, I'm going to pay you 4%, 5%, 6%, 8%, whatever it is you want on this money. It's going to greatly outweigh what you're going to be able to do with it in any kind of bank or account that you're going to look at doing. Could we talk about how you frame that kind of conversation?
I ask them, I get them to talk about what they're doing now to prepare for retirement, what they're doing now to invest their money. What kind of return are you getting? How are you doing in the market right now? You know, a friend of mine told me that the average person in the market after fees is making less than 2%. Have you heard that? And I just remain quiet. They let them simmer for a little bit. What if I could provide you a scenario that paid you a return that was 400% more than what you could get in a traditional bank savings account or a CD? Would that be interesting to you? What if I could outperform the stock market by 200% in a return?
Yeah, sounds good.
Better yet. And what if I could collateralize that with real estate? Let me ask you, Jacob, when you go buy stocks, let's say you sell your house and go buy stocks. It's of my understanding that most people give their hard-earned proceeds to a total stranger on Wall Street who took a helicopter to work, who gets paid whether you win or lose. I find that interesting. And you don't even get collateral. You don't even get a receipt. What are your thoughts on that? And then I stay quiet. I mean, what do you say to that?
Yeah, I mean, what can you say to that, Tyler? These are all really good questions.
I would be a fool to, number one, take cash from my property. Number two, either leave it in a bank account or, God forbid, play in the stock market. I mean, oh, please don't do that. I mean, that's the worst thing ever.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Tyler, if I'm a seller now, I'm really starting to think along these lines and I'm thinking, well, Tyler's got something here. He's got some good points. I don't know what I'm going to do with my money. I don't have any great alternatives. So Tyler, I don't know. What do you propose now? I mean, you're asking me all these questions. I don't have a ton of answers. I haven't really thought about this. What could you do for me, Tyler?
Well, one of the things I'm going to talk to them immediately is I'm going to throw them out a couple different options. In other words, I want to get them off of all cash if possible, because the reality of it is I'm not going to pay all cash for a property and full price. Okay, that's just not going to work. So once we establish that, we got to get to the why are they selling. We've got these options and the things you're thinking about. Well, let's get down to really why you're selling, because whatever offer I propose to you needs to match and solve whatever problem we're trying to solve by selling this property. Is it you want to capitalize on an up market? Well, good. We can do that by giving you a structured return, a guaranteed return over time in the form of a note and a mortgage on this property. So we can give you, let's say, a 5% annual interest rate for the next 30 years. You're guaranteed to receive 5% on a property that appreciates. Not bad. 100% collateralized with real estate. Can't beat that. There's that available. If you absolutely need all cash, we can do that. Obviously, we would need a significant discount if we're going to part with cash, because you know as well as I do as investors, for us to invest all of our cash into something means that we don't have that cash to build our portfolio. It's limited to just your home. And if I'm to do that, that is a very risky situation. Therefore, we'd have to buy it at a significant discount. What type of discount, Jacob, do you feel would be fair?
Tyler, I really like my house, so I don't know. How does 5% sound?
5% doesn't sound bad. Is that, do you really feel that's the best you can do and that's completely fair based on where we are in the market and whatnot? You see how the conversation goes? It gets you thinking,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
it gets those creative juices flowing. And no matter what, it eliminates our competition because everybody else is walking in there completely disarmed. They're as scared as the seller is. We're going in there and educating. We're asking questions, probing questions that make them think. And when you can accomplish that, the negotiations are going to go so much smoother for you because the people believe that you care, and because you do, or you wouldn't be asking the questions in the first place.
Yeah, Tyler, I really feel like you're actually have some of my best interest as the seller in mind too. Like, have you thought about this? You know, what's your take on this? Do you think that's fair? You really it's not so much of hey, my name's Tyler, here's my offer, take it or leave it.
Right. Because if you do that, what do I have to judge it on? At price. That's the only thing I can say, yes or no, based on price. There's nothing else to think about. And then any other offer that comes in, if it's $1 higher, it must be a better offer, right?
Yeah, right.
So that's the big difference there.
Well, Tyler, now that you've got the seller to agree to the idea of seller financing, what are some common terms in a structure like this?
Well, I don't believe there really is anything common. First of all, we got to think about what can the asset afford to pay. In other words, we're going to keep this property as a rental because I'm not a flipper. I think flipping is irresponsible, even though I used to do it. It can only afford to pay so much. And what determines that is how much will it rent for? So if we've got a house, let's say that rents for, $1,000 a month, how much can that asset afford to pay? So we'll use a calculation to determine what that is. And it's called a hurdle rate. It's a quick test method. We'll take the rent, the gross monthly rent. And if you guys are listening, you can do it along with me. Take the gross monthly rent. Let's call it $1,000 a month. Okay. This property will feasibly rent for $1,000 a month. We're going to divide that $1,000 by 1.5%. That tells me that theoretically, based on $1,000 in monthly gross rent, I cannot pay more than $66,000 for this property. If I pay more than $66,000 for this property, there's a pretty good chance I could fail because the asset, the property, cannot afford to pay exorbitant debt service, okay, a big mortgage payment. Now, this is a very loose calculation. It's a quick test guideline. It tells me a ballpark idea of where I need to be. Okay?
This is a variation of what some people hear as a rent-to-value ratio, right, Tyler?
Correct. Yeah. Absolutely.
So this is a 1.5% rent-to-value ratio.
Correct. Now, that's admittedly conservative because I'm a conservative investor. I'm a little too old to be taking huge risks and losing money at this point in my life. I'm not 20 anymore. A lot of people would sometimes they call it the 1% rule. For me, I think that's a little scary. You could lose money using a 1% rule. I use a 1.5. I know others that use it too. It does mean I look at a lot more property. I look at a lot more deals to get things done, but my deals don't lose, and that's the difference.
Yeah. Okay. So we've kind of got a general idea in our head of where we want to be based on the rent. We've got an idea of the maximum purchase price we can pay based on an estimated rent with this multiplier, if you will. So now we've come to $66,000. Where are we at from there?
What I will do is use what they call a T-bar. I learned this from one of my mentors, Larry Harbel. He taught me to use what they call a T-bar. And basically, I list all the expenses and I verify those expenses with the seller, make sure they're accurate. In other words, Mr. Seller, the water bill is $124 a month. Is that correct? Yes, it is. Okay. And the property taxes after I buy it are going to be whatever it is a month. And the mortgage payment, all the expenses are going to be listed out. And it's going to cost me this much for a property manager and whatnot. Well, based on that, after taking all the expenses out of that $1,000 of rent, here's how much I have left over in profit. And let's say that number is $400. Mr. Seller, how much of that $400 do you feel that would be fair for me to keep for doing all the work of maintaining this property? And let them give you an answer. I don't know, $300? Okay, so that means I've got about $100 left for debt service. So I can pay you $100 a month. Mr. Seller, at what point do you want me to stop writing you checks? Wait for them to answer. Sometimes they won't answer because they're not quite sure how that question goes. Because really, at the end of the day, the purchase price doesn't matter. It's what the cost of control is. That's what really matters. Well, I need $100,000 for my house. Okay, we can do that. I can give you $100. If the asset can only afford to pay $100 a month for the house, let's say, I'm just using that as a number. It could be $500. It could be $1,000, whatever. Let's say $500. The property only has $500 available to pay debt service. So that means, Mr. Seller, I can't give you $550. I can only give you $500 a month. And traditionally, most loans are 30 years. So I can only pay you this much for the property based on that. Unless you can tell me somewhere in these numbers where I made a mistake and you spin that legal pad around, you let them do the numbers. Because if it's their math, it's correct. If it's my math, then they're skeptical. Does that make sense?
Yeah, right. And it kind of gives them the next, an extra slice at the pie, if you will, to say, hey, yeah, this looks right. I mean, it adds up. It is what it is.
Right. Now, this is one of the reasons why I don't do single family, because here's what goes on. Like in our market right now in the Tampa Bay area, buyers are paying a fortune. They're paying a premium for a house. Using my calculations, a house that rents for $1,000 a month, people are paying $200,000 for. Does that make any sense? Not as a rental, but does it make sense if you live there? Well, only you can answer that because you're paying that bill. It's not my job to tell you you're overpaying. So as a rental property, it doesn't fit rental criteria. But as a duplex, because here's what happened in a situation like this in a hot market. If you're trying to buy single family houses using what I just showed you, you would be losing money every time. Mm-hmm. Because the prices are too high. If you're going to pay market value for a house, the prices are simply too high in a single family house to be able to afford the payments. So that said, you have to switch over to multifamily to make it all work. With that said, when the seller comes back to you and says, hey, I need more money. Well, that's great, but the tenants aren't willing to pay more rent. So how are we going to fix this? Are you able to raise the rent before I buy the property? Because based on you needing $200,000 for this duplex, Mr. Seller, I need to get $3,000 a month out of the tenants that are now paying $750 a month. So can you go ahead and raise the rent and get new leases signed for me? Well, no, they'd never pay that. Why? Okay, so if they'd never pay that, what would they pay? Well, they'll pay $800. Okay, so based on $800, so if you've got two units paying $800, that's $1,600 gross revenue minus the expenses leaves us $124. Of that $124, Mr. Seller, I still have to pay you in the form of debt service and make a profit. And as we can see, those numbers don't work. So let's try again. Because we're always tying back to those numbers, Jacob. We can't change the expenses. We can't make them look better to make ourselves feel better about ourselves. The expenses are the expenses. We're not getting around it. And that is your strongest negotiating tool, is you got to get the seller on board with, I can't make these expenses go away. Which one of these expenses do you want to prepay for me? I'll buy the property, but I need you to go ahead and pay the taxes for the next 30 years. Then we can take that off my calculation. Well, are they going to do that? Of course not. And this is the thing that most investors miss. They don't do this. They don't go through this thought process to realize that, guys, these expenses are what they are. You can't change it no matter what.
Now, Tyler, do you ever run into a scenario where the seller just doesn't care about your line as the investor? Do you ever just get like a throw your hands in the air? Like, hey, look, if you want it, this is what it is. Take it or leave it kind of mentality from a seller?
Oh, absolutely. It happens on a regular basis. But here's the thing. When that's the case, what I find more often than not is those properties don't wind up selling, or somebody walks in, a newbie investor, and grossly overpays for the property. When that happens, I can almost tell you that that property will turn into a foreclosure. I'm going to wind up buying it anyway. We've already done that where I've lost a negotiation on a property. Somebody else went in and bought it, used the mortgage, and then got it foreclosed on. And 2 years later, I wound up buying the property anyway, but I bought it cheaper than what I was willing to pay for it the first go around. So I'm okay with that.
Yeah. Okay. So now that you've kind of got the seller understanding where you're coming from with the listing the expenses, proposing to them like, hey, how much of this profit do you think that I deserve for doing all of this? Now you're starting to really come to some hard numbers. Okay. Well, now we're going to pay you, let's say $500 a month for the next 20, 25, 30 years. And that's kind of like where you really begin to put pencil to paper on getting a contract. Is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah, Tyler. Well, it sounds like you've certainly got a lot of negotiation tactics in your back pocket going into this. And your main focus is to really educate the seller, understand what's motivating them, and then try to come to some agreeable terms. And I think that's probably a lot of new investors miss, is trying to be that problem solver like we talked about.
Right. You're not going to be successful consistently strong arming people. That's just not going to work.
Yeah,
right. You're going to have to take that approach of educating people and listening to them and listening to why they're selling and realizing that, ladies and gentlemen, not every property is investment quality. It's just not. And it's okay to walk away.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that makes a lot of sense. And you're absolutely right, Tyler. You can't just make every property work. You know, you've got to understand that some properties are just not meant to be. Well, Tyler, one question that just pops into my mind is, you know, you said this method isn't always the best approach in single family homes because they are valued a little differently. People are willing to overpay in some markets for these homes, and therefore it's not an investment criteria or investment grade property, if you will. What kind of properties do you find that this approach works best on?
My methodology works in, as far as for multifamily, in all markets across the country. It definitely works in all markets. In the single family space, the numbers still work based on the seller's motivation. Okay. A motivated seller is willing to sell their house essentially for a lot less than a non-motivated seller. But if the property doesn't have any issues, if it doesn't have any problems, or the seller does not have a compelling need to sell, then no formula or no situation that you come up with is going to work in that type of situation, because it's simply not an investment grade asset, period. It's that simple. So the key is qualifying the property up front, looking at a property and going, well, it's priced at 200 grand. It rents for $1,000 a month tops, because let's say it's a depressed rental market for whatever reason. That's not a property I'm even going to bother trying on, because the numbers just are too far apart. It's just not worth it.
Yeah, right. So there's just too much ground to be made up.
Absolutely. So we'll just move on to something a little more realistic. The worst thing you can do is beat your head against the wall trying to negotiate a deal where there simply isn't motivation.
I've been there before, certainly, Tyler. I'm sure you have too.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Well, Tyler, as far as the multifamily space for this approach, is there any certain like size of multifamily that this works best on that you found? Duplexes to fourplexes, larger multifamilies? Is there any sweet spot there?
The numbers work across the board on all sizes of multifamilies. It could be a duplex. It could be 5,000 doors. It doesn't really matter. My thing is I prefer to just stick with the small to medium sized properties. And the reason for that is the larger properties are there's a lot of competition with, but you know, you got insurance companies out there buying large assets and big hedge funds, and they have certain requirements to place capital. They've got to move money. They don't have a choice. So for them, they'll do a deal just to do a deal. A lot of that is Wall Street funded. Wall Street, they have certain regulations that say when they take on investment capital, they've got to place that in a given amount of time, or they have either give it back or they run into compliance issues. So for them, if they are my competition, so to speak, in those larger assets, I'm never going to get where I need to be because they think, you know, a 3-4% return is epic for them. That's huge because it allows them to make something, right? Where yeah. I need a much higher return to make it worth my time and worth my while. What I find is that some of my best deals come off the MLS. And I'm going to tell you why is that most real estate agents, the people who list the smaller to medium-sized multifamilies are usually residential agents that have very little experience. They're greedy or hungry, whichever way you want to look at it. Real estate agents that have no training, no experience in pricing multifamily. They don't know how to price it. They use comparable sales, which any investor knows. Comparable sales in multifamily is pointless. It doesn't make sense. The value of a multifamily property, the value of any investment property is tied to the income it generates. There's no getting around that. That's how you really achieve the true value number. So based on that, and this is my mindset, based on that, it doesn't matter what the guy down the street did with his fourplex. It doesn't matter because what really matters is how much income is that guy getting for his fourplex. If he gets $4,000 a month gross rent for his place and I get $2,000 a month for mine, his place is worth a lot more money than mine. So his isn't really a good comparable of mine. Comparable, you can't use his numbers because I can't pay you based on what the property will do. I can only pay you based on what the property does do.
That's a really good point, Tyler. I think that probably shouldn't be glossed over here. You're, in other words, saying I'm buying a property based on what it's currently doing, not what it's projected to do in the future.
Correct. If you want me to pay you based on the projected situation, then go ahead and get it to that point and I'll pay that.
Yeah. How many times do you look at a property, Tyler, or see a property on the MLS and says, currently renting at $1,000, could rent for, you know, $1,400 or something. And you're like, well, then why is it not renting for $1,400 right now?
I see that more in quote-unquote off-market properties than I do in on-market properties.
Really?
There's been a shift. See, on-market properties, frankly, are a better deal these days than the off-market stuff. Because the off-market stuff, there is no scrutiny. There's no professional standard. There's no nothing. You've got some ding-dong that took a guru course who sits there and says, well, this thing, well, the projected income is $9,000. Yeah, but it's not even, it's vacant now. And the whole back of the building
is stripped out of the studs.
Right. The back of the building's missing, and I think it's on fire.
Yeah, well, that's kind of a misconception, Tyler, what you just said, and maybe it doesn't exist in every market, but what you're saying is sometimes the off-market deals are not as good as the on-market deals.
I can show you in every major market where that is the case.
Really?
Every market, absolutely. The off-market deals are becoming less of a investment-grade criteria than as the on-market ones.
Wow, yeah. Well, that's certainly surprising. I'm sure it sounds surprising to some, Tyler. Tyler, another thing is when you're looking at these on-market deals, most of the time they're listed by a real estate agent or broker, and it's hard to have that conversation directly with the seller when you're approaching them for this seller financing strategy. How do you manage to get around the agent or broker, or do you?
I don't get around them. What I do is involve them in the transaction. In other words, we all want to be the smartest guy in the room. Nobody wants to be left out. Well, everybody wants a trophy. You know, they say the fat kid always wants the trophy. So knowing that's the case, I will spend time building rapport with the agent first. Now, granted, it's a little easier for me because I am an agent. Okay, that does make a difference. They look at me a little differently. They look at me as a colleague instead of someone that's going to steal their money. They know that I'm held a certain standard and that if I don't play by the rules, that the state can pull my license. So they're a little less threatened by me because I'm an agent too. So that allows me to have a conversation with them. And then I always suggest, hey, let's do this old school. My buyer's old school. They're the type of folks, they want to sit down, get on a conference call or have a face-to-face, have a cup of coffee. Let's negotiate this out so we can create a win-win. So the seller can win, the buyer can win, you and I can get paid, and everybody can go on about our business. How about that?
Yeah.
Now there's a certain degree of agents and certain number of agents that are absolutely terrified of that whole thing. They're like, oh my God, I can't look somebody in the face and negotiate. I'm going to burst into tears.
But in this scenario, Tyler, you are the agent and the buyer. In other words, you're acting as the same person.
Correct.
Okay.
Now, I also work as an agent for other people. I help other people get opportunities as well. But usually I wind up being, more often than not, I wind up becoming an equity partner in the deal. It's just the way I give them the option. You can either hire me as a real estate agent or you can bring me in as an equity partner. Obviously, I have a great motivation as an equity partner to get an even better deal than I could as just a realtor. So, I mean, let's call it like we see it. It is what it is. If it's going to be mine too, then we're going to negotiate it based on my standards. And I'm pretty strict when it comes to my investment grade criteria.
And one thing I'm sure you're having to overcome in this scenario, Tyler, is that listing agent, I'm sure, feels like they could get cut out of the deal if you go straight to the buyer. Is that true?
Yeah, oh yeah, absolutely. I would never go straight to the buyer. Even if I wasn't an agent, I still wouldn't go directly to the seller. I think that's unethical. I believe that if two people have a contract to do something, I should respect that contract. It's not my place to go around that contract. I think that's bad, bad business, bad karma. I would never do that. I would never advise any investor do that. At the end of the day, it's not hard to build rapport with people if you just don't assume what they're going to do. Have a conversation with people. And that's the thing. We live in a society where if it's only true, if it's on Facebook and we're afraid of having any communication that's not a text message. It's unfortunate, but I come from a place where that's not how things are done. Let's go have a cup of coffee. I'm buying, or beer or whatever, and we'll talk about this and we'll work this out so everybody wins, because that's really what it comes down to. If you can do a win-win, it's the only way to do business. I won't do business otherwise.
Yeah, right. Well, I think those are all really good strategies and tips for people out there looking to maybe do one of their very first deals. Tyler, this is a great strategy to get into a deal with little or no money down. And, you know, it can be a phenomenal way to solve both the seller and your problem. So yeah, I think it's a great strategy and probably one that's overlooked by a lot of people.
Oh, I guarantee it's overlooked by a lot of people, because we can put together probably our closing ratios are running around 70%. 70% of the sit downs we get, we walk out of there with a contract.
Wow, that's phenomenal.
Well, it's because they have more to choose with us than just price. We can actually solve their problem. How about that? What a concept.
Yeah, there you go. Well, that's what it's all about. And awesome, Tyler. Well, Tyler, let's shift gears here and talk a little bit about you personally and professionally and with your real estate endeavors. You're out here doing a lot of real estate deals. What are your future goals personally?
My wife and I we love to travel. Matter of fact, literally, I just got back a day and a half ago from a little cruise to Mexico, and we were in Tennessee a couple of weeks ago before that, and we've been all over the place, Belize, the last couple of months. So we love to travel. We're focused heavily on building our portfolio right now. We're in buy mode. That said, we're in a position to where people say, well, is now a good time to buy? Anytime's a good time to buy if you're buying based on the numbers working. Okay. We stick to our criteria. We focus on solving problems, and we are in buy mode right now. So our future goals are continuing to build our portfolio, both of multifamily properties and non-performing notes. I love non-performing notes. We've done very, very well. We've made huge returns with both us and our investors. So we've been doing that consistently now for about 2 years, and it's just, we're killing it. So we're pretty happy about our results there. And I'm going to continue educating people. I love having the podcast and the YouTube channel and all that. And I just love helping people get to where we are.
Yeah, awesome. Tyler, it kind of sounds like you've also kind of given your reasons why, but I also think that's important to drill down on, because without having a reason why, your task at hand can kind of sometimes get lost in the trees, if you will. So I mean, it sounds like your reason why is to, you know, continue to build passive income for your family, do the things you love. Is there anything else that kind of drives you?
It does. My wife has MS, muscular sclerosis, or multiple sclerosis, yeah. Rather. And she was identical twin. We lost her sister about 2 years ago. She passed away at 45 years old suddenly. And Julie never really got a chance to live life to its fullest because she got put into a wheelchair in her early 30s. So she missed a lot of life being in a wheelchair and being disabled. Jill has, my wife has the same disease, different symptoms, but not to the same degree. So we right now we're taking time to live our life now and have fun and build our portfolio and get comfortable now, or rather get uncomfortable so we can later be comfortable. That's my big why. I want to give her that quality of life that unfortunately her twin sister did not get to have. So that's our big push right now, is to really enjoy what we're doing and have the income to be able to do it.
Yeah, awesome, Tyler. I think that's great. And, you know, real estate is one of those few things out there that will allow you to do such a thing. So awesome.
Yeah, there's a lie out there that talks about, you know, you're supposed to work your tail off until you're 65 and then retire and settle on live on less money. That never made any sense to me. I won't.
Yeah, Tyler, well, I'm younger than myself, and it's never made sense to me from an early age either. So, yeah, well, Tyler, as we're wrapping up here, we've got a lightning round. It's just a series of questions we'd like to fire at you and just get your answers. How does that sound?
That works for me.
All right, cool. Tyler, our first question is, what was your biggest hurdle getting started investing in real estate, and how'd you overcome it?
For me, probably finding money or finding financing. I was that kid that didn't have really good credit at the time. I didn't have really much money coming in. So trying to get the capital together to do real estate. Once I realized that I didn't need my own capital, I could just use somebody else's. And I learned how to do that by solving problems and educating people. That was the game changer for me.
Yeah, awesome. Okay. Tyler, do you have a personal habit that contributes to your success?
Yeah, I don't accept what I believe to be true as fact. I ask questions instead. In other words, I'm not the smartest guy in the room. I'm not going to pretend to think that I know what somebody's thinking. So in all cases, when I have a question over what somebody may be thinking, I simply open my big fat mouth and I ask them.
It's a good approach. Okay, I like it. Tyler, do you have an online resource that you find valuable?
YouTube for me is like, it's my college. I love YouTube. I mean, it was funny. I was terrible in school. I was a terrible student in high school. I was never there. I was smoking pot, doing other dumb stuff that kids do in high school. I hated education. Now as an adult, I can't get enough of it. And YouTube is my go-to source.
You can really learn almost anything on YouTube. I'm convinced.
I'd have to agree with you. I can't think of anything you can't learn on YouTube.
Some obscure task you need, it's on YouTube. Exactly. Exactly detailed, exactly how you need it. So yes, yeah. Definitely so. Well, what book would you recommend to the listeners and why?
This one may throw you guys for a loop, but How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie.
Oh, yes.
It's a classic book. Most people skim through it, but I got to tell you, that book changed my life. It is the Bible I go to when it comes to learning how to negotiate and refining my skills. I read it every year without fail.
Tyler, it's so funny you mentioned that. One, yes, it goes hand in hand with The Art of Negotiation. And I just restarted it this morning. So it's funny you say that. Yeah, absolutely. Well, Tyler, our very last question. If you were to give advice to your 20-year-old self to get started investing in real estate, what would it be?
I would say start before I thought I was ready. I waited too long. Not that I'm dead yet, but I wish I would have started when I was in my 20s. I didn't think I was ready. I didn't think I was smart enough, and I didn't think I had the money or the brains to do it. Now that's all a lie. What I should have done is started immediately before I was ready. Don't wait to be comfortable because you're never going to be comfortable. Get uncomfortable, get it done.
Yeah. Great advice, Tyler. It's a common theme amongst all real estate investors is they just wish they would have started sooner.
Absolutely.
Well, Tyler, as we're wrapping up here, is there anything you'd like to leave with our audience? Any parting piece of advice?
I would say learn how to be a pig. And people are thinking, what the heck is he talking about, be a pig? Well, what I mean is a professional information gatherer. The more information, he who holds the information holds the key to the gold. And the only way you're going to get the information is to ask questions. If you think you know everything and you assume the answers to everything, you're never going to get anywhere. Get good at getting information. Information leads to wealth.
Yeah, great. I think knowledge is power. And the best hedge against risk in this game is it to educate yourself. So yeah, absolutely. I completely agree.
Absolutely.
Well, Tyler, you've certainly given us a ton of great things to think about, some actionable content around negotiating and talking with a seller and just being an all-around problem solver today. And we really thank you for your time. Thank you for coming on the show. And we look forward to speaking with you next time.
Thanks, Jacob. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you, Tyler.
All right, that wraps up our interview today with Tyler Scheff. Tyler has given us a ton of great information, resources, and scripts for negotiating seller financing. If you have any questions about anything mentioned on the show today, feel free to reach out to either Tyler or myself, and we'd be happy to answer any questions. If you like what you've heard, please leave a rating and review on whichever platform you're listening on. As always, if you have any questions or comments or want to hear something or someone specific, reach out to me. You can contact me at www.jacobayers.com/contact or connect with me on Facebook at The Real Estate Way to Wealth and Freedom. Till next week, signing off, I'm your host, Jacob Ayers.
You've been listening to the Real Estate Way to Wealth and Freedom podcast, providing you actionable content to build your real estate empire. Nothing on this show should be considered specific, personal, or professional advice. Please consult an appropriate tax, legal, real estate, financial, or business professional for personal advice. The opinions of guests are their own. Information is not guaranteed. All investment strategies have a potential for profit or loss. The host is operating on behalf of the Real Estate Way to Wealth and Freedom, LLC, exclusively.